in 1911, there was a group of business people. Before Pittsburgh Rotary was founded in 1912, for instance, these men met every Monday in the old Fort Pitt Hotel, which was on the space now occupied by the Convention Center, and they called themselves the Hungry Club, and they would eat and discuss community needs and community problems, and this became a famous source of social change back in 1911-1912. These would have been the people that sponsored the merger of the city of Allegheny with the city of Pittsburgh, which brought the north side into the city. This was the group that contained A. Leo Weil Sr., who became the moving force with the Hungry Club people, the forerunners, incidentally, of the Allegheny Conference, because they were community doers, and they created a unified school board. In those days, every district had its own school, its own school superintendent, and each of these sections, for instance, Uptown included the old Central High School, and Fifth Avenue became Fifth Avenue High School. Then there would have been another section over in the north side, and so on. But they consolidated these various school districts into the Pittsburgh Board of Public Education, and having been elected, they now abandoned elections and got the school board named by the judges of the Court of Common Pleas. Mm-hmm. And isn't it strange that it took till 1970 to go back to what we were in 1911, where we now elect school board directors by district, one of the most wasteful of all human pursuits. Who can create a Democrat Republican fight on who sits on the school board? It is so silly and so wasteful and so parochial, because you now have people fighting for an individual school instead of fighting for the whole system. Anyhow, the Hungry Club did a lot of good things, and down through the years, John Weaver became the moving force of this thing. He might have been paid $100 a month. He was always basically a poor person. The Hungry Club eventually moved to the downtown YMCA, but he kept this thing going all the way up into the 60s. Now, what happened was when we got into the 50s, John Weaver began to use radio, and we were sponsoring public discussions, and I had the pleasure of working with John and being on radio. And then when QED started, we created programs of a public nature before PBS and some of this national stuff, and we were creating programs once a week for WQED, which incidentally had different call letters in those days. Subsequently, John Weaver got old and retired, and there were a few bucks left over, and so I was the only survivor of this process. So I put the Allegheny Roundtable funds in Point Park College, where they presently reside, and kept going a couple of people to sponsor discussions of what the college might do. The money now gets used for the creation of television shows for use on publicly owned stations as an educational arm of the Point Park College program of teaching radio and television. Fortunately,
DUQ, is that DUQ related?
No, DUQ is Duquesne. That would be, no,
oh,
that's,
pardon
a,
me, no.
No, that's a station. Yeah. The Dumont was the forerunner of KQV, and we did things with Dumont.
Well, you mentioned
WDTV was the original television call letters for KBKA.
You mentioned that you were on the radio. Well,
yes.
Tell me a little bit about
Well,
that.
What we did was on a weekly basis, WJAS would sponsor public discussions, and John Weaver would invite some of us in to talk about public issues at the time. The significance of this is that there is an idea that to this day exists, because what I was hoping was that Point Park would eventually do television of various school board meetings. For instance, I wanted the school board meeting to be televised at Fox Chapel that could be shown to the Mount Lebanon School Board, and the Mount Lebanon School Board's televised proceedings to be used by the people in Monroeville, and continue to use this medium for town meetings of the year. As a matter of fact, this is one of the things that John Weaver sponsored in those days. Town meeting of the year became a national program, not having to do with us, but we always managed parallel discussions of contemporary problems with a so-called town meeting of the year.
What years were these?
These were back in the 50s, in the middle to late 50s. It was an exciting opportunity to take advantage of contemporary communication systems. And it was a thrill for me to be part of it, as you both would recognize now, knowing how much fun I had. There you go.
Say, Pete Flaherty was what?
He was not a builder.
He was not a builder.
No, he was a conservative man who put our city back 50 years with some of his short-sightedness. And he drove us away because prior to him with Joe Barr and before that Governor Lawrence, we had a progressive, forward-looking Democratic Party that really attempted to enrich the city. And Flaherty was a beginner. He and Bill Hunt, who was a classmate of mine at Pitt and subsequently became the Republican County Commissioner, just the two of them stopped the Skybus, which was an attempt by Westinghouse to prove on a monorail out at South Park the efficacy of the use of the monorail, which now is world-renowned. And Westinghouse was so advanced in its people mover concepts. Their program, the Skybus, exists in most of the major cities of Europe.
Yeah.
It exists in Tampa Airport. It exists everywhere, and it meant 25,000 jobs for Pittsburgh if only this stupid mayor had not stood in the way of letting this thing evolve.
Well, that was a political...
Absolutely a political move that was... The thing that Flaherty to this day doesn't understand is there is no free lunch, that the cost of government is costly and we have to pay for it. And if you can get benefit out of it, and this is one thing Flaherty as a lawyer never understood, is cost effectiveness. And one of the things that you learn in business is to make investments that are cost effective. In certain situations, you want your money back in 3 years or in 5 years or in 10 years, depending on the nature of the asset. But in the case of government, there can be no measurement comparable to what exists in business. This is the argument I'm having to this day with Tom Murphy, whom I'm planning to back for mayor because he's so imaginative. In the case of the legislature wanting to provide a $900 subsidy for individuals to go to private schools. And just yesterday, I wrote him a two-page letter trying to give him things to realize that might inspire him to stop that process. The legislature failed to pass this law because they questioned its constitutionality, but they didn't face the basic issue that to put a $900 subsidy on a private school is to destroy the monies available to enrich the public school system. And he argues, Bill, I've waited 25 years for the public schools to get better. I said, but that's no reason now to take our resources and spend them on subsidizing a private school experience, which is only designed to satisfy the ego of the parents. I appreciate the fact that the Catholic schools take thousands of kids off of the public school rolls. But that's because they want those children to have special advantages which they, as Catholic parents, think they can afford. And the Jewish parents the same way, and the Seventh-day Adventists or whomever thinks they want private schools to control the mind processes of their children. That's a private need which they should pay for. I also point out to him that we're already paying for transportation for private school students. We're paying for special education for kids in need. And most important, we're paying for math and science. The Catholic schools that can't afford math and science teachers have two options. One of them is to send the kid for the second and third period in the afternoon to the public school to get math and science as a public school contribution where there's no religion taught and no attempt made to destroy their loyalty to the Catholic Church. And so you're providing math and science, you're providing public transportation, and you're providing special education with tax funds. Enough already?
Yeah. You're talking about Boudreau.
Yeah, oh, what a character.
What a character, what a god.
Oh, what a character. But he got things done in terms of keeping Maryland Symphony going. And this year, 1992, he will spend the summer ending up at Barcelona, where we're going to have the Olympics. And the barge will be there.
Representing Pittsburgh.
Representing Pittsburgh with H.J. Hines and Westinghouse and Alcoa and U.S. Steel's emblems on the barge. It's an incredible story. It turned my stomach that he was able to get $800,000 in the year in which I was the treasurer to get this barge designed.
You mean the new one?
New barge designed, point to counterpoint, designed by Alfred Kahn, the famous world-renowned architect from Philadelphia. I thought he was crazy, but in the meantime, the barge creates an art gallery in its hold, and every time Boudreau went to a country, he would sponsor an art exhibit, and I say, whatever art was left over after it was sold, he kept. Sometimes they stolen. But so when you go on to the barge at any given time, you'll find some eclectic materials, a fabulous painting from Colombia, a piece of sculpture from Tunisia, where wherever Boudreau goes, he ends up getting something to add to that collection.
So therefore, wouldn't you say he's worth his trouble?
Oh, he's worth the trouble because he created at least 200 original pieces of music. He was the first one to bring Penderecki to the United States.
Yes.
And Penderecki was featured at the Pittsburgh Symphony in 1991. But Penderecki wrote a special piece for the American Wind Symphony back in 1962.
Right.
I happened to, I don't know if I told you or not, I happened to join forces with a friend of mine. Both of our fathers had died, and we were both doing business in West Virginia. And so we gave Boudreau $2,000, and he got Robert Russell Bennett to write a West Virginia symphony that is now part of the permanent repertoire of the American Wind Symphony. It's a beautiful piece of music, and Boudreau conned me out of $1,000. But it was worth it, because this is the way Boudreau got things done. One year we agreed to let him house his students at the Point Park dormitories, and he never paid us. And he was a great taker, but he did create a significant body of human knowledge that'll last 1,000 years. And he's been advertising Pittsburgh on the inland waterways of Europe for the last 2 years. At the end of this year, I think he plans to lead the parade into New York Harbor for the 500th anniversary recognition of the discovery of America by Columbus. So after the Point Counterpoint spends the summer at Barcelona, it's scheduled to come into New York Harbor.
This is Johnny Karsh, who
is a honky-tonk piano player down in the Bahamas. Mm-hmm. And one year we were down in Fort Lauderdale before the when the kids started to take it over, and we ran into him, and he played the ragtime piano on this honky-tonk piano that he carried around. We had heard him initially in the Bahamas, and then we found him a second time in Lauderdale, and he was nice enough to give me four pieces of music written by Scott Joplin, which I play on the piano now. Mm-hmm. If you have time, I'll be glad to play for you with all the respect.
Well, wait a minute. I'm going to take you up on that. I want you to say, what are you doing? Where did you get this? Where did you get this?
Now, actually, this is some music that I got as a gift from Bob Darsh down in Bahamas many years ago. We ran into him, a honky-tonk piano player. That was the first exposure I had had to Scott Joplin. Scott Joplin had been a famous black piano player composer back to 1912, 13, 15, 1922. And each of these pieces that Scott Joplin created represented a breakthrough because they were the beginnings of some of the contributions of black musicians back in those days. And of course, the most famous one is The Entertainer, which became part of a movie. He had done Maple Leaf Rag and The Sunflower Slow Drag and Peach Time Rag and on and on and on. And
Porcupine Rag is that's the Bible.
No, that Mark Twain says.
That's
that's
Jeremiah.
My father got it for 7
yeah.
years.
This is January the 7th, Tuesday. Howard Braun is here with Bill Stark. We're going to go over some odds and ends papers of his, basically not to do any recording, but as he picks up this or that piece of paper, I may want him to just vocalize the title and the main point of it.
Some notes I have of a discussion I indulged in December of 1959 on our basic business philosophy in our business as we operated it. We were a total union shop. And we're very proud about that fact. We had little turnover, and our total objective was protecting the dignity of the workers. We had no strikes in our business. We started in 1931, and I got out in 1972. Over 50% of our employees were with the company from 7 years to 40 years. We treated the union with the same consideration as our best customer, and so it made it very easy to survive. We were great in the human relations area, figuring this was our responsibility in the running of a business. We had an understanding with foremen and then the higher authority that if they wanted to establish or clarify company policy, they were to call on the union steward to make sure that everybody was advised as to what was likely to happen.
Yeah, Bill, did you have any non-union competition?
Significant, all of our business life, yes. And it didn't bother us because our longevity factor and our high productivity factor and employee loyalty transcended any advantages that others might have had in price. Okay, boss, we were it. Didn't get an agreement to the union. Oh, here was a cute. We always had a company policy of getting the agreement with the union to violate the contract downward. If we had to provide some benefit to the company in violation of the union contract, we always got the union's acquiescence first. Okay, trying to get the...
Yeah, well, the American Mercantile Association.
Pittsburgh Mercantile.
Yeah, well, no, those are... Yeah.
It was a captive store system for Jones and Laughlin and its coal mines and steel mills. And
I never cottoned to that.
No, because it was gone before you...
It was gone before my time. Yeah. I also know what's wrong with it.
What was wrong with it was that they were giving people low wages and never giving them free money. They had them running on script from the time that they took a job in the coal mine. And if you worked, you didn't get money. You got credit in their store, and they made a profit on the store, and they made a profit by keeping the wages
up. There's something even more fundamental. When you hire a person, Bill, you've handed me notes of dozens of speeches you've given over the years. Make some comments in general. How did you happen to make so many?
One of the reasons was that I considered my job as president of the company being a... are you taking...
I'm taking some, yeah.
Being president of the company, my job was to enhance the image of this company in the community.
Yeah, but the title, so how can you move Brotherhood forward?
Well, because I was the chairman of the National Conference of Christians and Jews.
Okay.
And so I would have had to make that speech at an annual meeting.
And labor relations?
Well, and the question of labor relations would have been delivered at the annual convention of the Institute of Industrial Launders,
or at
the Chamber of Commerce meeting, or
and Boy Scouts,
and
Little League.
I would have been addressing a college class. I went down to Waynesburg College to speak to their economics class and to Washington and Jefferson by invitation of somebody that heard me speak. And Boys Club and Little Leagues, I was president of Hill City in the 60s, and we had annual meetings, and I had to preside and make a presentation for the awarding of prizes to the little black youngsters. And
you have an address to businessmen, delimit technical jargon.
Well, that was because my introduction was that I wasn't attempting to be a wise guy. An expert is a man that's 100 miles away from home and has a big mouth and not too many good ideas.
And treating labor leaders like best customers. Where did you get that idea?
That would have been, the treating your labor leaders like your best customers would have been delivered to the Young President's Organization, to the Institute of Industrial Honors, to the Chamber of Commerce. That was always a pitch of ours, that trade unions deserved utmost respect because properly lived with, they constituted members of the family and made for industrial peace as well as domestic peace.
Be damned if I know where this one
was
given.
This one is
explore random thoughts.
The more random thoughts on the how do we survive? This was a speech delivered for the benefit of the Jewish Labor Committee and
year was that?
This would have been December of 1973. Mm-hmm. How we relate behind the headlines with New Times, and the whole speech would have been related to my general feelings of optimism. Life limits human waste, and some of these famous statements that I would have picked up, attempted to incorporate.
What have you got there?
This is I'm writing a children's book. My granddaughter, I promised it at age 8, she's now 18, and I haven't produced yet, but the key story about a little friend of hers, age 8, who watched the 6 o'clock news with her grandmother and said, "Grandma, this is only riots and rape and bombings. Do you watch this every night?" And Grandma said, "Yes, I do." She says, "Well, now I know why you're always so dumpy and uptight."
Yeah, you say you wrote recommendations.
Yeah, recommendations to the State Board of Law Examiners for young people wanting in 1970, wanting to be given admission to the Pennsylvania bar.
But were you just a soft touch for everybody?
Well, it wasn't a matter of soft touch. It was the fact that I was a successful business person and a friend of their families.
Uh-huh.
And this was assigning an application to further implement their capacity to satisfy the requirements of the State Board of Law Examiners.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Here you are. Notes on Building Jewish Identity. You're always saying you're not not religious. What the heck do you think religious means?
Well, the point is that I went to this annual meeting of the American Jewish Committee as a chairman of the Pittsburgh chapter in 1965, and this workshop had some very interesting observations on how Somerville, New Jersey, and New York, and Wilkes-Barre, and other cities in the country were able to develop an interest in Jewish identity among their younger people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But do you think you were immune to Jewish identity?
It wasn't a matter of being immune. It's a matter of saving this for the future reference because I wanted to relate to it as a means of enriching our own community. That would have been my objective.
What are you muttering about now?
No, I'm just trying to figure out ideas.
What is that test of a what kind of a society did you say?
No, actually, I was trying to find out what the test of a healthy society.
What's that?
Reflections of Eric Hoffer. Eric Hoffer was that fabulous social philosopher who never went to school and became a world-renowned social philosopher.
Yeah.
Vigor and creative flow have their source in internal strains and tensions. Mm-hmm. You remember you were telling
me
how my own anxieties gave rise to some of my drive to build a better world, and this is a mere verification of that statement that you made. So here we go again, the social policy improving the human condition, and wanting to write this speech on social responsibility, which I'll do because of my relationship with you and your having convinced me that some of these ideas deserve to be written up. So when they're finished, I'll share them with you.
I will be pleased.
Put your name on it.
My suggestion, incidentally.
You're helping me because you're helping me.
I'm helping you simply by being here and so that you have a motive to look through them.
Watch your emotions, profiles, courage. Oh, boy. Here's a key. One speech I heard once in describing a person's capacity to talk, it's like the top half of a double boiler that lets off steam but doesn't know what's cooking down below. Well, these are my observations.
Oh, there are tons of those kind of aphorisms, yeah.
What's
that?
Some of these. Let me see if these universities are turning out highly skilled barbarians. Well, this is an interview with Stephen Mueller, the president of Johns Hopkins.
Mm-hmm.
These are some papers that I've saved to write on the 129 governmental instrumentalities about which I am very, very disappointed in the fact that I want to push for the elimination of the city of Pittsburgh government.
What's the
this is
here?
A scientist's views of mitzvah.
I see.
This is a piece by Herbert Posner of Reformed Synagogue in Durham, North Carolina, Devar Torah back in the 60s and 1975, and it sort of emphasized my own search for what I really stood for. Caused an ethic as a psychedelic tranquilizer. And some other papers here on extrasensory perception, which I've been discussing for 40 years with my daughter, who did some work on that in college. And Daniel Berrigan's speech to the Arabs in 1973.
Did you ever meet Berrigan?
No. No, I wouldn't walk across the street and see him.
Good.
Because he was a negativist.
And, yeah.
They drew attention to themselves instead of the validity of their arguments.
Mm-hmm.
The immorality of higher education, the use of power, the use of the army, and the use of love as they relate to the immorality of higher education.
Mm-hmm.
So I must take the time to write up some of these ideas. Oh, here was the speech. I've done a lot of work with prisoners. And
the prisoners in jail.
Jail people, yes. Financially supporting this female offenders program and some other things. And when I started the Senior Citizen Services Corporation, we were looking to how we could help released prisoners get jobs. I've always had a special interest in that, and so I think I can still be of some help. Okay, these are various papers and ideas that I'll have to relate to.
Are prisoners dumber or smarter than those people?
Well, I just think that in their own way, if they're able to beat the system, they would be construed to be smarter,
mm-hmm.
And their unwillingness to protect their own best interests by staying out of jail proves that they aren't really as mature in their thinking as they might be. See, here's another thing I wanted to relate to, that in the earlier days of starting of our country, where the ethos sustained group interests before private property came into play, there was a place for evangelism, and to try to go back and recreate that setting is an exercise in futility.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, look how many people are succumbing to the evangelism of the born-again Christian movement. We've isolated individuals because we have, as a society, placed special interests before group and individual interests, so that the whole society is disjointed where I sit, because the emphasis is on the wrong things. And of course, with the influx of increased use of television and homogenizing people's thinking, we're going to have a more difficult time, as time goes on, trying to get people to face the issues of a better world.